Radio.
Christianity and the Liberal Tradition, Friend or Foe? A presentation by Alex Sadu at the Christopher Dawson Center for Cultural Studies 2015 Colloquium.
Thank you, David, for the opportunity to speak today at the first Dawson Colloquium. The topic I'm going to speak on today is Christianity and the Liberal Tradition, as Philip has said. There continues to be much debate over the relationship between Christianity and liberalism, both liberal political structures and liberal political theory. This is particularly true of Catholicism. From consistent explicit criticism and condemnation of so-called liberal social and political movements, which advocated freedom of conscience, speech and religion, and mass democracy prior to the 20th century, reading the documents of the Second Vatican Council, one cannot help but be struck by what seems, at first glance at least, to be a virtual about-face on these matters, if not an open embrace of liberal political theory. Indeed, a theorist no less than the standing of John Rawls argued in his work The Law of Peoples that Catholicism, as a result of Vatican II, in particular, the recognition of the right to religious freedom as based in the dignity of the person, is now more or less compatible with his own political liberalism. It's quite a statement. It is not possible in this short paper to adequately capture the full complexity of the relationship between Christianity and liberalism. In part, this is due to the many different ways in which the term liberal is understood and used in different Western societies, both within popular and academic contexts. For my part, I use and employ the term liberalism to denote political theories which hold the fundamental or ultimate political value to be some conception of autonomy, liberty, and/or equality. For me, when all is said and done, what distinguishes a liberal from a Catholic political theory is that the liberal theory holds to some understanding of autonomy and or equality as the most fundamental political value, whereas for the Christian, this will be their commitment to God. For the Christian, the ultimate political value is the transcendent truth, who is God, a trinity of persons. The liberal, by definition, cannot hold this foundational political commitment without ceasing to be a liberal. A liberal democracy, therefore, on this understanding, would be a democracy that embodies some form of liberal theory, rather than simply any democracy that recognises certain personal rights and freedoms or other limitations on power. Liberalism, I believe, is best understood not as a political system with a particular structure, but a political structure that embodies a particular political theory. It is also important to distinguish between actual political orders and political theory. We often hear of Australia or other Western nations being described as liberal democracies. I believe this confuses the issue somewhat. The political order we have in Australia, and indeed those in other Western societies, are not the embodiment of a single unified political theory, liberalism. Rather, they are the outcome of a complex history of political bargaining, compromise, both pragmatic and prudential judgment is involved, and influenced by a range of different philosophical and theological ideas. The Australian political system is not purely a liberal system of government. In this paper, I want to suggest that Christianity, in particular referring to my own tradition, where I'll give some examples, the Catholic tradition, is not compatible with liberal political theory, focusing in particular on anti-perfectionist liberal political theory. Tracy alluded to this in her talk briefly, so hopefully this will complement some of what she's said and maybe develop it in a slightly different direction. This type of liberal political theory, or its main claim to fame, is that it argues the government or the state ought to remain neutral on fundamental, metaphysical, and theological matters. I want to outline two key difficulties in very basic terms as part of the paper. First, I want to offer a critique of the liberal anti-perfectionist claim to neutrality between rival conceptions of the good, or the argument that liberal theory can remain neutral with regard to fundamental, metaphysical, and theological positions. Second, I want to expose the truth claims of so-called anti-perfectionist liberal theory, which are supposed to be, the theory, supposed to be neutral between these rival metaphysical and theological truth claims. I want to argue, far from being simply about autonomy and or equality, we can find the outlines of a very controversial conception of the person and the nature of human existence in these theories, and I'll focus particularly on Rawls's theory. If there's time, I'll briefly say a bit about the way forward, perhaps in light of these insights. One of the themes of this colloquium is a celebration of dangerous ideas. Christianity, I would contend, from the point of view of the dominant understanding in contemporary society, is a dangerous idea. Dangerous because increasingly Christians, and indeed Christianity itself, is viewed as harmful to society. Simply to express Christian teaching and ideas in public on such subjects as human sexuality and the current climate are viewed as able or likely to cause harm or injury to a range of individuals. Indeed, one not look further than the Tasmanian context to find such an example of this. Rodney Croom, I'm sure as most of you are aware, from Australian Marriage Equality, recently charged that the distribution of the Australian Bishop's pastoral letter on marriage to Catholics, particularly parents with children in Catholic schools, was likely to cause harm, and therefore we might say dangerous, particularly to those experiencing same-sex attraction or those being raised in same-sex households. He condemned Archbishop Julian for having the temerity to distribute this pastoral letter to parents with children in Catholic schools. He condemned a Catholic archbishop for merely seeking to inform those within the Catholic community of Catholic teaching on marriage and sexuality. How have we come to this point where a Catholic archbishop is accused of potentially harming people in simply promoting Catholic teaching? As Archbishop Julian has noted in his own response to this attack, in part through articles that he's written in the diocesan newspaper, in an age that is increasingly emotivist and subjectivist, to believe in and make claims to objective truth is viewed as a form of intolerance or bigotry towards others. It is to presume to judge others' views as wrong. Truth, it is argued, or the claim to truth, is harmful or dangerous. Yet, should we be surprised at this trend in Western society? Perhaps the most influential political philosopher of the 20th century, John Rawls, his entire political theory was based around the notion of truth being fundamentally dangerous to the stability of modern Western societies. To call Rawls a liberal is somewhat of a misnomer in this regard, for at the core of his political philosophy is not so much a fundamental commitment to liberty, but to stability. Rawls was concerned with the problem of pluralism, or conflict, between rival conceptions of the good, and the danger this posed to the ongoing stability and peacefulness of contemporary Western political orders. Rather than seek actual common ground or a workable modus vivendi between rival parties, in his work A Theory of Justice, Rawls sought to move beyond claims to truth and instead develop principles of justice for the governing of society based on, or which could be justified by appeal, to an ideal decision procedure, instead of some particular claim to the true human good. He sought to devise a decision procedure to provide the basis for principles for the governing of society which all reasonable individuals might affirm regardless of their differences. realizing some years later that there was a problem with the wording of the argument, which meant that it could not be viewed as relying on comprehensive truth claims, Rawls sought to recast his theory in explicitly political terms, so that it could remain on the surface, philosophically, theologically speaking. The result of this work was Political Liberalism, which was based on a collection of essays that he wrote after A Theory of Justice, modifying that theory. Rawls was not concerned with liberty or freedom of the individual as such. Rather, these concepts or ideas were only useful to the extent that they provided the best way to achieve long-term social and political stability. He believed that only societies in which individuals have a sense of freedom and justice are likely to be socially and politically stable in the long term. Liberalism itself is really the attempt to address the problem of social and political pluralism, I believe. It seeks to provide a way of structuring and governing society that all might be willing to accept despite their particular metaphysical or theological commitments. In this way, all liberals, not just anti-perfectionist liberals, I believe, are ultimately concerned with the problem of stability. In this, Rawls and liberalism more generally are the product of modern political philosophy, arguably the father of which is Thomas Hobbes. It was Hobbes who was first to clearly state that the central political concern or focus must be to ensure the stability of society in the face of rival interests. For Hobbes, this was best achieved through the Leviathan, through force. Rawls seeks to better realise the Hobbesian desire for political stability not through overt force, but instead through the appeal to apparently neutral political principles which can unite all people regardless of their particular conception of the good. What these modern theorists such as Hobbes, Locke and Rawls share in common is the rejection of claims to objective truth in politics, or as the foundation for political principles. Politics, it is argued, should not be about seeking what is good and true. Rather, they claim is ultimately about stability. Claims to objective truth, it is argued, are fundamentally dangerous to the stability and well-being of human societies. They are dangerous, they argue, because they do not admit of compromise. That consummate European politician Pontius Pilate was the very embodiment of this mindset. Indeed, given the opportunity to stare truth in the face, he asked, "Quid est veritas? Truth, what is that?" Pilate, like modern politicians, was faced with social unrest and instability. So truth itself was sacrificed by Pilate for the sake of political stability. We know, however, that God used the sinfulness of man in Pilate to achieve reconciliation between God and humanity. For it was through the sinfulness of man, the weakness of Pilate, that Christ was put to death. Authentic Christianity, properly understood, however, is far from being able or likely to cause harm or injury. In fact, it is the opposite of a dangerous idea. Christianity, far from being an idea, in actual fact, is a way, or for Christians more precisely, it is the way to true human fulfillment and happiness. The denial of objective truth, particularly in politics, is in fact the most dangerous idea I believe we confront. If the political order is not based on the true understanding of the human person, there is potential for great evil and suffering to occur, as has been witnessed in the 20th century. What has allowed theorists to deny engaging the question of truth in politics is the further claim that I want to address in this paper, that it is possible to engage in politics in such a way as to remain neutral between metaphysical and theological truth claims. We regularly hear in the popular media that Christians, or indeed any person with strongly held religious beliefs, ought not to seek to impose their religious views on others through government, legislation, or policy. They argue that the state or government can and should remain neutral on theological or metaphysical truth claims. The religious believer, we are told, should take off or put aside their religious beliefs before entering debate within the public realm. This has been a central claim of those referred to as anti-perfectionist liberals, such as Rawls. The work of the Thomist philosopher Alistair MacIntyre is helpful in exposing the problem with this claim to neutrality. MacIntyre notes that the notion that one can remain neutral between rival conceptions of the good ultimately has its basis in the discredited epistemology of the Enlightenment. He critiques two assumptions in particular of Enlightenment epistemology. First is the notion that reason and understanding are independent of social and cultural particularities, and that these particularities are merely an accidental clothing of reason in particular times and places. Second, and following from the first, is the presupposition of universal conceptual fixedness, or the belief that all rational persons conceptualize data in one and the same way, and that therefore any attentive and honest observer, unblinded and undistracted by the prejudices of prior commitment to belief, would report the same data, the same facts, but also that this is the data thus reported and characterized which provide inquiry with its subject matter. I'll start first with the notion of conceptual fixedness. The problem with this presupposition, according to MacIntyre, is that there is no simply given neutral, natural, or impartial way of conceptualizing and characterizing reality, particularly human actions and the social and political world. Rather, we are confronted with equally ultimate rival ways of conceiving and understanding how things are. Not only do we lack a universal rational standard to which appeal can be made to resolve our moral and political disagreements, more importantly, we lack a given natural or more basic way of conceiving and conceptualizing how things are. MacIntyre maintains that theorists such as Thomas Kuhn and Gaston Bachelard have taught us that, relative to any particular type of inquiry, there are always at least two modes of conceptualizing and characterizing the data which constitute its subject matter: a pre-theoretical, although not of course preconceptual, prior to inquiry mode, and a mode internal to that particular type of inquiry, which already presupposes one theoretical or doctrinal stance and commitment rather than another. MacIntyre cites Kuhn's example of a stone swinging from a line to make his point. Those innocent of inquiry see and report the stone swinging from a line. A theoretically committed Aristotelian will observe an instance of constrained natural motion. An adherent of Galileo, a pendulum. The criteria for identifying everyday objects and persons are pre-theoretical, so we are able to assert that this is one and the same swinging stone which is observed by both Aristotelian and Galilean physicists. But, argues MacIntyre, there is no way of identifying, characterizing, or classifying that particular datum in a way relevant to the purposes of theoretical inquiry, except in terms of some prior theoretical or doctrinal commitment. What is true in the case of physical inquiry, MacIntyre argues, holds also for theological and moral inquiry. In attempting to resolve disagreement between those inhabiting rival moral and political standpoints, we lack the ability to appeal to some more basic way of viewing and understanding reality. We are always already making sense of reality, in particular human action and the social and political order, through some particular way of conceiving and understanding, and cannot engage in inquiry without some prior theoretical or doctrinal commitment. This means that there can be no stripping away of bias and prejudice to reveal a true, natural, objective, and impartial way of conceiving, characterizing, and understanding how things are, as the theorists of modernity, particularly the Enlightenment, believed. There is no more basic materialist or physicalist way of conceiving that is less controversial than other philosophical ways of conceiving. They are all equally ultimate and equally controversial. There is no neutral or impartial ground which one can stand to see how things really are and act as a neutral adjudicator. This would be the God's eye view, so to speak. It is therefore not a matter of deciding whether to theorize through a particular theoretical standpoint or not. Rather, it is a matter of one's self-awareness of the theoretical standpoint through which one is always already inevitably conducting inquiries. Aristotelian, Augustinian, Thomist, Humean, Kantian, Hegelian, Marxist, Husserlian, liberal, analytic, phenomenological, existential, etc. Or some combination of several different standpoints. For example, with regard to the moral and political reality, where Aristotle's formulations are in terms of arche, techne, psyche, logos, ergon, praxis, pathos, arete, and polis, Hume deploys the terms impression, idea, passions, calm, violent, nature, artifice, virtue, society, government. The disagreement between those affirming rival conceptions of the good is therefore vastly more significant and complex than a disagreement concerning the nature of the human good. For the disagreement between rival standpoints extends to how we actually conceptualize, conceive, and characterize the moral and political matter in dispute. And more generally, human action and the social and political order. In other words, systematic disagreement upon fundamental issues extends to disagreement over how such disagreements are to be formulated and characterized. With regard to reason, McIntyre argues that as there is no absolute way of conceiving and understanding, everything must emerge from history, from some specific social and cultural context. Moral and political inquiry, indeed reason itself, are tradition constituted and tradition constitutive. Reasoning always already takes place within some particular context, within some particular theoretical framework, and on the basis of some particular way of understanding. There is no pure reason that comes from nowhere. Rather, reason is always already situated in some particular context. History is not simply, therefore, peripheral or ancillary, some distant academic field of inquiry. Rather, we are the very outcome of history. And while we are, of course, and while there are, of course, rival histories and narratives, there is as yet no neutral, independent, or non-historically situated standard to which appeal can be made. McIntyre employs the concept of tradition to capture the necessarily social and historically situated nature of our particular way of conceiving and understanding. To appeal to tradition is to insist that we cannot adequately identify either our own commitments or those of others in the argumentative conflicts of the present, except by situating them within those histories which made them what they have become. Whether we recognize this or not, we are inescapably the bearers of tradition. Whether we realize it or not, we are necessarily situated within a particular narrative or overall context. The particular theoretical framework or conceptual scheme we inhabit is therefore also situated within some broader history or tradition, according to McIntyre. For McIntyre, it is not a matter of being faced with the choice of whether to live our lives within a particular tradition or not, or the choice of whether to theorize within a particular tradition or not. Rather, we are confronted with the choice of self-awareness or ignorance, the choice of becoming aware exactly of what tradition through which we are always already inescapably living and always inescapably theorizing, or remaining entrapped in ignorance. The further important point we can distill from McIntyre's work on these two issues is the non-avoidability of truth claiming in moral and political argument and theorizing. While as far as we can ascertain, we have no neutral independent standard to which appeal can be made to resolve disagreement, the further insight McIntyre contributes is that in theorizing and arguing, we cannot escape necessarily making and relying on claims to objective truth, or what is unqualifiedly true. In advancing a particular moral or political claim, we are ineliminably advancing a particular claim concerning how things are. We advance such a claim or undertake such theorizing on the basis of things being the way in which we can see them and understand them to be, and not otherwise. If things are otherwise than we conceive and understand them to be, then the claim or theorizing would not make sense and would be without grounds. As McIntyre puts it, what is being claimed on behalf of each particular moral standpoint in its conflicts with its rivals is that its distinctive account of the nature, status, and content of morality is true. And it is because we believe our understanding is unqualifiedly true that we advance particular moral and political claims over opposing claims. McIntyre further argues, conceptions of justice and of practical rationality generally and characteristically confront us as closely related aspects of some larger, more or less well-articulated overall view of human life and its place in nature. One only continues to actively maintain one's particular moral and political position on the basis that one's particular way of conceiving and understanding of reality, human nature, action, and the moral and political order is true, in that it is not affected by distortion or misrepresentation. There is no way to avoid relying on, therefore, some fundamental truth claim in living our daily lives. There is no way of avoiding relying on some claim about the nature and purpose of human existence. It is simply a matter of what we believe and how consistent and well-developed this understanding is. If Christianity is not informing political decision-making and policy development, it'll be some other fundamental commitment, most likely hostile to the Christian understanding of reality and the human person. We need to therefore ensure that Christians are not silenced in the social and political arena, or their religious views are not prevented from being active in the arena, simply because they hold religious beliefs. Everyone holds and lives their life on the basis of some fundamental or ultimate beliefs. We can call these religious beliefs. Everyone. We need to bring these beliefs to the fore in public policy debates. We need to unearth the presuppositions of those who do not publicly express their commitment to any particular religious belief, to ensure that it is clear that they are necessarily imposing their fundamental beliefs on others when they advocate particular political or social policy. The truth is not dangerous to politics. Rather, what is dangerous is to try and hide that all of us have and operate from some fundamental set of values or belief system about the nature and purpose of human existence, some hierarchy of values. What is dangerous and injurious to society is not to expose these unavoidable truth claims. Those who do not express religious views in the social and political order are not somehow neutral with regard to metaphysical and theological commitments. They unavoidably remain committed to some fundamental set of values, some set of metaphysical or theological commitments. The second feature I want to focus on is the vision of the human person and human existence we find at the heart of the modern liberal social contract theory approach that Rawls advocates. In the attempt to move beyond the inherent limitations of human knowledge and understanding, the modern tradition formalizes a dualistic understanding of reality, the seeds of which can already be found in the work of late medieval nominalism. It attempts a cleaving of the orders of nature and supernature. And this cleavage or cleaving has fundamentally impacted our understanding of the nature of things, particularly our relationship to the divine. I want to use the work of the radical orthodoxy theorist, particularly Catherine Pickstock, to develop this point. According to the radical orthodoxy theorist, modernity and the logic inherent in the works of the modern thinkers is best understood as an anti-theology that is ultimately nihilistic. Pickstock speaks of modernity as the emergence of an unliturgical world, whose ideal course involves the eradication of the unknown, the choreography of spontaneity, and the anticipation of all eventualities via a textual calculus of the real. What she means by this, I believe, is that modernity involved the attempt to achieve absolute certainty in knowing in order to overcome all elements of disorder in human nature, and indeed nature itself, and in some sense achieve a divine perspective of things through purely human effort, reflected in the presuppositions that McIntyre's criticised. The belief of the modern thinkers, according to the radical orthodoxy position, was that critical or scientific human reason, unaided could understand more accurately the nature of our situation, specifically the nature of human existence, than theology could through divine revelation. That human reason alone could establish an absolute foundation for human knowing without recourse to God. This was combined with the idea that somehow nature, in particular the human person, human nature, is self-sufficient and independent from God and can know all reality accurately and with absolute certainty without the need for God. As opposed to the understanding in Christianity that nature and all creation have been created by God through Jesus Christ and remain radically dependent on him for continued existence. The radical orthodoxy position views this understanding, the modern understanding, not simply as a radical rejection of Christianity, but essentially nihilistic. It argues that the attempt by these thinkers, the modern thinkers, to treat worldly phenomena such as language, knowledge, the body, apart from God, in order to try and safeguard their worldliness, in fact, to the contrary, is to make this worldliness dissolve. For without appeal to eternal stability, one has to define a purely immanent security. Yet this immanent security, in the form of an immanent static schema or metathesis, can only be grounded in nothing, and one must assume that this essential structure is only an illusion thrown up by the void. In rejecting God as the ground of all things, the modern project, in practical terms, sought to gain control over reality through a project of metathesis or spatializing knowledge, that is to say, trying to map all knowledge onto a manipulable grid. The problem is that in trying to grasp absolutely all knowledge in this way, there can be no assurance of achieving anything but subjective assertion. There is no eternal ground to which appeal can be made, only human subjectivity. Instead, radical orthodoxy proposes a theological framework of participation as developed by Plato and reworked by Christianity as an alternative configuration. With this framework of participation, there is an acceptance with postmodernism of the indeterminacy of all our knowledge and experience of selfhood. It construes this shifting flux as a sign of our dependency on a transcendent source which gives all reality a mystery rather than as adducing our suspicion over the void. There is no claim to absolute knowledge or to represent reality in its fullness. Truth is regarded as unchanging, eternal, but yet not fully graspable and immediately available. Pickstock, in her own theological project, has attempted to show how philosophy itself and its Platonic guise did not assume, as has been thought or projected back into ancient philosophy, a primacy of metaphysical presence, but rather a primacy of liturgical theory and practice. According to Pickstock, Platonic philosophy did not seek or claim absolute metaphysical certainty or a metaphysics of presence. Instead, it was about leading a liturgical life in worshipping God through the denial of radical human autonomy and self-sufficiency. The social and political works of modern thinkers, particularly the social contract theorists Hobbes, Locke and Rousseau, they argue, are necessarily premised upon an anti-participation theology. This is manifest in their work, specifically in the contract theorists seeking to base their political theories in a supposedly more basic, natural or primal understanding of human beings than that found in Christian scripture. It is also evident in their reduction of Christianity to religion, or the creation of religion as a purely private inward matter to replace authentic, publicly embodied Christianity, where Christian faith is to have no role or consideration in governing society except as a means of producing and maintaining civil unity and obedience to the state. Rawls seeks to avoid all this controversy and disagreement by a method of avoidance, avoiding metaphysical and theological matters, where he does not explicitly approach politics on the question of justice or on the basis of some comprehensive doctrine, tries to remain on the surface, but instead on the basis of modern ideas and ideas found in the culture. Yet from the radical orthodoxy position, Rawls' method of avoidance already indicates its fundamental rejection of Christianity and the theological framework of participation in its stated attempt to remain neutral towards God. As already mentioned, the most fundamental concern for Rawls's political liberalism is that of conflict. For Rawls, politics and justice are to be understood in terms of fundamental conflict over scarce resources, requiring an absolute or definitive solution. This way of viewing politics and justice, however, is not neutral, impartial, or more basic or natural, but a highly distinctive conception of politics which rejects the Christian understanding of human existence as one of original peace, or what John Milbank describes, for one that John Milbank describes as original violence. According to Milbank, this belief of original violence in the context of modern politics is that there is only chaos, which cannot be tamed by an opposing transcendent principle, but can only be imminently controlled by subjecting it to rules and giving irresistible power to those rules in the form of market economics and sovereign politics. This logic is embodied in political liberalism. The original political problem for Rawls is that of original conflict, or as Milbank puts it, original violence. There is nothing more important or crucial to understanding human beings with regard to politics than conflict and the need to resolve conflict. In this way, Rawls's approach to the question of politics and justice necessarily favours one particular story of human existence over others, in particular, the Christian understanding. According to Milbank, Christianity recognises no original violence. It construes the infinite not as chaos, but as harmonic peace, which is beyond the circumscribing power of any totalising reason. From the Christian perspective, the notion of original violence is a rejection of humanity created in the image of God, where original harmony and integrity between the relationship of God to man, between human beings with nature, was lost through original sin, bringing about what is an unnatural state of conflict and disunity in the whole of creation. What in the Christian understanding is unnatural and foreign to humanity's true nature is, in Rawls and the social contract theorists, its most basic feature. There is no further or higher truth for Rawls that must be considered. There is only conflict and the need to overcome conflict. Nothing matters more. The Christian theological anthropology of Imago Dei, or being made in the image of God, is replaced by what is now considered the most important way of understanding the person with regard to political matters. The person has free and equal will, presupposed to nothing but base self-interest. The most basic and primary feature of politics and justice for Rawls is therefore one of original conflict between rival, free and equal wills, each seeking to gain more of what they desire according to their desire or conception of what is good for them. Eternal salvation through Jesus Christ is no longer the most important consideration in all decision-making for Christians on fundamental political matters, on Rawls's take. This is to be replaced with salvation by the Rawlsian state. In developing political liberalism, Rawls therefore can be seen to develop a counter-soteriology to Christianity, that is, a competing story of salvation. Both Christianity and Rawls have the same goal, the salvation of humankind from the divisions that plague us. Rawls argues that we must give our highest allegiance on fundamental political questions to the achievement of earthly stability in the form of the demands of reasonableness, reciprocity, and public reason. Christians argue that our highest political allegiance must ultimately be to God and his vision for human happiness and fulfillment, and that true and lasting peace will only be realized by the second coming of Jesus Christ. Rawls's work, whether intended or not, is therefore premised on an argument that the most important consideration on fundamental political matters is political stability, in a human sense, and not eternal salvation. For Rawls, it is a salvation offered by the nation-state that is politically more important than the eternal salvation offered by Jesus Christ. In seeking to achieve perpetual peace through purely human structures, instead of recognising that true peace can only be realised through the divine, Rawls is implicated in what Catherine Pickstock has referred to as necrophilia, the love of dead things. In prioritising the concern for purely earthly peace over that of the life to come, Rawls gives up a lasting or eternal peace for a pseudo-eternity of merely spatial permanence, which, unlike genuine eternity, is exhaustively available to human gaze. Rawls advocates that we go after what for him appears more real and permanent than what is actually lasting and permanent, eternal life with the Holy Trinity. The problem is that going after what appears more real and tangible, Rawls is actually grasping after what is dead or dying. In preferring the finite over the infinite, Rawls is preferring dead things over what is truly living. Some final remarks about the way forward. The question of an authentic political approach is complex and is clearly beyond the scope of the paper I'm presenting today. Yet radical orthodoxy provides some basic guidelines or assistance. It establishes that there can be no compromise with any form of theoretic liberalism, such as Rawls's political liberalism, or any approach that does not recognise God as the ultimate source of all that is. As Milbank notes, if theology no longer seeks to position, qualify, or criticise other discourses, then it is inevitable that those discourses will position theology. For the necessity of an ultimate organising logic cannot be wished away. There is no neutral way of approaching fundamental political questions. If the Christian does not approach these questions on the basis of a Christian theological framework, it will be on the basis of some other theoretical framework. Theorising about politics is, of course, different from actual political practice, where political structures are the outcome of complex historical processes of conflict, disagreement, and compromise, and never the embodiment of any single well-developed theory. Yet the same basic approach applies. Political structures that embody a non-Christian theological framework are to be treated as imperfect and tolerated rather than embraced by Christians. Social and political orders that embody such an understanding are accepted as a reality that one cannot avoid, but must seek to resist, in the same way as one would seek to resist the ideology of totalitarian systems. What is central is that for the Christian, there is no permanent or lasting home on earth, and no political theory or structure that can finally embrace as their own. The only true political community is the kingdom of God, which is not realizable through human effort on earth in its fullness, but something which will only arrive with the second coming of Jesus Christ. I'll finish up there.
That was Alex Sadu with Christianity and the Liberal Tradition, Friend or Foe. This presentation was part of the Dawson Centre for Cultural Studies 2015 colloquium on the theme, Ideas Dangerous to Atheism. For more talks, interviews and shows, visit cradio.org.au.